Hello and welcome to We're All Gonna Die and Other Fun Facts, a semi-regular, occasionally amusing, and rarely funny series of conversations on a random topic. This episode is entitled Make a Joyful Noise, which I did steal from Psalm 98. This is our first stole from the Bible podcast, but that's relevant. We'll talk about that later. And it's about having lots of fun singing about sad things. And our guest for this episode is someone who makes a joyful noise quite often with his band Hard Rain, Mr. Bill Toms. Thank you again for coming back, being on the podcast for a second time. You didn't learn the first time. Stay away.
The wind just blew me this way. Yeah, thanks for having me, Matt.
Oh, you're welcome again. Thank you again so much for doing this. This podcast would be nothing without the guests. It would just be me, and who wants to listen to that? So I guess the big thing is, so what's new in your world?
Well, obviously we got a new record. I say record as a new CD that is being released next week called Deep in the Shadows. And that's what I've been engrossed in for the last 6 months, trying to get this thing together and pulled together. So, yeah, looking forward to it. Excited.
Yeah, that is exciting. You know? 6 months, man. That's... yeah, I mean, that's not exactly Chinese democracy, but I mean, I think it's also, I think, the perseverance to, like, grow and love and nurture something. And
well, it's not even, I mean, the recording aspect of it is fairly quickly. I mean, we did this fairly, a lot of live playing. You know, we didn't spend making overdubs and there wasn't anything like that. It's more like the business side of things that takes time, you know, and plus getting the musicians together and, you know, the artwork and this, that, and the other. So,
yeah,
it takes a lot of time.
Yeah, it's just calling people, hey, where are you?
Yeah, right. That's exactly it. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, so that's almost like, I guess that's one of the things, I guess, for people maybe outside of music that they don't really recognize is how much. Like there's that sort of rock star stereotype or that sort of musician stereotype is, you know, the guy who smells funny and has a van kind of thing, yeah, you know, right, just right. Kind of totally impractical, but
right.
This, you know, quarterbacking, organizing.
I think people would be surprised to understand how organized you know, production it is just to keep the machine rolling, you know, and when I say machine, I maybe just, you know, at least sputtering, but even with the, you know, your people that have been around forever and we think of them as, you know, big rock stars, you know, I'm thinking somebody like Mick Jagger, who was really one hell of a businessman. He was a very organized person, you know, deliberate, very deliberate. I mean, there's Bob Dylan, and if you read about the things that he did with his manager, they were deliberate, you know. So it's all marketing and a lot of that stuff. People, it's not just get in a van and drink a lot and do drugs and fall asleep, you know.
Yeah, yeah. And I guess, too, I mean, even in the playing, too, is, you know, I think great musicians make it seem effortless, you know. And I think there is that sort of aura, you know, at being at a good show and whatever, you know, a band seem almost sort of weightless, you know,
right.
Like they, you know, run on this sort of a magic invisible fuel or whatever, when actually there is all of this work that goes into it, you know, and all this sort of, I guess, thinking practically too, right? I mean, as much as, you know, again, music is this thing on one hand, it's about emotion, it's about, you know, the beat, it's about thing. Just thinking about, okay, what needs to be done this week, you know? Is there sort of like a task list or in the spreadsheets? And
yeah, well, maybe not that far sometimes, but yeah, I mean, yeah, definitely. There's a you know, I get up every day and I think, okay, this is what I've got to do today. You know, because this is due next week. I've got to get this done today. If, you know, I'm pretty good with that. I'm pretty organized, you know, when it comes to that kind of stuff.
Yeah. And I guess also is it, too, in terms of when, like, you're making a record like this. And I know you said recording went kind of quickly. You know, I mean, there's a sort of, I mean, two famous stories, I think, in you know, sort of the indie alternative world. You know, it was My Bloody Valentine worked on a record for 19 years. Literally was like tweaking levels and like plugins or whatever.
Right.
Well, does that sound quite right? I know when their amazing record in 91 Loveless came out, somebody from the label said, and the label was broke. And they just, it was one of those where like each record financed the next record.
Yeah.
And so we need another record. You know, it's like paycheck to paycheck right. for a thing. And literally the guy just had to call the head of the labels, had to call them every day and yell at them. Is it done yet? And then they released the record themselves to, you know, some fanfare, but 19 years.
Yeah.
And I follow the Wrens on Facebook and they're following up their 2004 album.
Right.
They posted around New Year's. The final mix is done. And then last night, well, we're still working on it.
Yeah. I think it's easy to get lost in that technology. Yeah. You know, we were talking about that earlier. I think that it's too easy to lose yourself in that.
Yeah.
You know, and the hardest thing to do is to step back and say, you know, what are you trying to accomplish with this? And really, you know, for me, I guess I go back to, you know, when records were done and you know, the people made 45s.
Mm.
And, you know, you would make like two albums in a year. You know, you were always recording. I mean, I can remember reading about, you know, the Rolling Stones. Like, you know, you go out on the road, play your gigs, come back and record a song.
Yeah.
And so to me, that's the power of it, is the live performance. And I try to get as much of that in the studios as I can.
So, yeah. So that's the thing. Yeah. Because your live shows are, I mean, I try to see you half a dozen times a year, which is actually not all the times I could see you a year. You play how many gigs?
Oh, it all depends. I mean, it depends on what we're doing. Mm-hmm. You know,
A couple times a month, though, it seems like.
Well, at least a few times a month. But then if we travel, you know, I'll be going to down south. And then we go to Italy. I'll be going to Europe in July. So that'll be, you know, there's between 10 and 12 gigs right there, you know. So it all depends on the situation. Yes.
But I mean, your live shows are, you know, just so much fun, and there's so much energy, and they sort of don't stop, you know? It doesn't stop. I mean, it's, you know, it's 2 hours of just exuberance, and then I get tired watching, you know what I mean? It's just like, you know, it's so much fun, and sort of, you know, sort of thinking about our theme or our title, you know, is this idea of, you know, getting all this joy out and not getting sort of bogged down, but yet lyrically, a lot of times, I mean, your stuff is about, you know, again, it's Deep in the Shadows is the name of the new record, and you know.
Well, I think too, I mean, when we talk about the live performance, I'm a strong believer that I have to really believe in what I'm writing, and it's very serious. I have a good time. I have an amazing, very at home feeling when I'm on a stage playing, but for me to have that fun, I take it very, very seriously.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. So I guess there's back end work.
Yeah. There's that believability that I have, that I have to have in the music, and the way we're presenting it, and also the fact that, you know, if you believe in something that strongly, you put more energy into it. And so all those things wrapped up, you know.
Yeah, which is so true. And I think that's, you're right. I mean, well, of course you're right. You know what you're doing. But I'm thinking about, like, the thing that I really enjoy about your shows is that sort of that authenticity that's there. It's not a show. I mean, I was always, you know, I'm a child of the post-punk era, you know.
Sure.
Where it's got to be real, man. You know what I mean? You know, sort of growing up thinking, like, Kiss and disco are like the most evil things ever. You know what I mean? If it's too big, it's not cool or whatever. And I'm still sort of colonized by that belief now, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But you're right. I mean, that sort of, you know, which I guess then is the relationship to your own songs and sort of like how you turn, I guess, is it like thoughts, feelings, beliefs into music too? So that's like maybe another component, right? That's all like bound up in writing a song. And
Yeah, I mean, you're definitely right. I mean, it's the music that you're wrapping around the lyrics, you know, and that's basically what we're doing, is we're wrapping this atmosphere around what you're saying. It's almost like a movie, you know. You're cutting a movie, and you have to enhance the imagery sometimes, and it may be only obvious to me. So it may mean something totally different to somebody else in the, you know, to the mm-hmm. audience itself. But to me, that's the honesty, and that's the beauty of music.
Yeah, I think that's right. And thinking again, I mean, thinking about this record and Memphis and all the shows mm-hmm. I've seen and stuff like that, is you're right. I mean, there is this sort of cinematic quality. I mean, you got mm-hmm. the one song, Air Feels Like Rain, parentheses, Paris 1943, right. Which is like, I mean, that in itself, I mean, that song is full of sort of these cinematic images.
Exactly.
And what I find remarkable about, you know, watching you play is sort of how generous you are with your band. You know, for a guy who's been playing guitar for, I don't want to date you, but you're a guitar master, right?
Yeah,
I mean, you are someone who can pick that thing up and make it work. And again, it looks effortless, but I'm sure it's, you know, tens of thousands of hours of practice playing shows that go into your, but you're always, you know, sort of the solos, the rest of the band gets to do stuff, and it creates this like amazingly rich sound.
Right.
Whereas, you know, again, you know, you're not Yngwie Malmsteen. It's not about, right. how many hammer-ons you can do.
Right.
Though I'm sure you could do that, but it's actually more about, oh, you know, let's Phil's play the sax, and you know, got the great Hammond organ, and you know.
Well, I like those sounds. You know, I love to hear a piano. You know, I love to hear the saxophone, and when somebody else is playing Phil's or in between things or solos on the guitar, they're not, it brings a different atmosphere sometimes to what I'm, where I'm standing, you know. So I'm not a big you know, play solos all night kind of person. I don't enjoy that. I get very bored with that after a little while, so
I had a roommate in college who was very into like Malmsteen and sort of virtuoso guitar, god hero things, and it was weird because almost the music was just sort of dispassionate, even, you know. It's sort of like,
I find that too. I listen to people that are like so technically proficient at their instrument that sometimes, not all the time, but sometimes you may get sort of displaced from where you wanted to be within the song itself, you know.
Yeah.
And there's a disconnect there.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And so that was always the fight we had. And of course, being punk rock, I wanted to put on Ramones records and things that sort of sounded purposefully awful, you know.
Right.
Lo-fi was happening in the late 90s. And so, listen to this. And he was just like, what is this, man? I don't even think the top end of the guitar is moving in the video. What's wrong, you know?
Right.
You know, sort of thing. And I was like, but the feeling is there. And in my old age, I've sort of reconciled, you know, both of those things. You just gave me a look when I said that. But
my
hair's really gray.
No. I kind of identify with that, too, because, I mean, when I started into the music industry, or not the industry, but when I just started playing in clubs, punk music was a big thing that we were very much into and aware of. I mean, the Ramones and, you know, the Clash were... You know, when I remember listening to London Calling, was like, it just changed the way I seen the way I was doing things. I mean, you know, at that particular time.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. I mean, the thing is, as someone who, you know, I was 3 when that record came out, you know, it was still like hearing that record for the first time is a moment.
Especially when you come up and you're used to radio and pop. Right now, I mean, like, you know, right now I don't listen to pop music. I mean, if I hear London Calling now, it's great, but it's pop music. I don't really identify with pop music now as much as, I don't know why that is. Maybe it's younger people. I don't know. Maybe I just disconnected with real pop music.
Well, I could say, because, you know, in my work life, I traffic in the lives of 18-year-olds.
Yeah.
And I think there's a thing for me, I don't know, I've seen a lot of, like, what they're into. I've just heard a lot of it before, you know. Yeah. And for them, even though it's a, quote, new band, mm-hmm. it's a new sound, I've been on that ride already. Yeah. And there's so many other rides to get on out there. Yeah. I mean, the world, the possibilities sure. for music are just so infinite, you know.
Right. That, and you begin as you get older too, is to think of music as timeless, you know. And mm-hmm. I think one of the things with this record, even more so than Memphis, was you start rechanneling these musical influences from when I was a kid growing up. I was a kid in the 60s, and I had older sisters. Mm. And it was like Motown and Stax, and all the soul music was very, very big. Wow. In my house and in my neighborhood in Pittsburgh was very big, you know, soul music. Mm. And I remember my parents, you know, listening to Ray Charles. And,
oh, yeah.
You know, it was very much, so I kind of like channeled, as I go here now, I'm like writing songs, but I'm sort of channeling that part of me,
yeah,
the music that I really, really loved when I was young, you know.
Yeah, which I think that the first track of the record, mm-hmm. I got no use for what you're selling me. I mean, I gave a friend a ride. I just had a meeting that mm-hmm. I had to be at, and I picked up a friend, and I was prepping for this, and by prepping, I was, you know, cleaning. I actually cleaned the room here. I this pile of paper here. That's this pile good. Of paper that I wanted to recycle. I cleaned for this, and was listening to it, and I picked him up in my car, and I was like, oh, check this out. He gets in. I was like, he wanted to tell me. So I was like, wait, listen. And just the horns on that record, and the mm-hmm. I mean, the play on words with the title, it was like, yes, you know, which right. also, too, is, you know, you think that uniquely sort of American music, or you think, you too, mm-hmm. I mean, there's like sort of this authenticity where I think we can also rally around and say, hey, you know, this was sort of our gift to the world. I mean, representative democracy
right.
and Motown, you know, that's what we got, you know.
Right.
No matter yeah. what. Thousands of years from now, America, you know, it'll be, you know, that and
yeah.
Motown and maybe the cheese or something, you know, when yeah, it's all right, over. Right. But
no, I think you're exactly right. And as I've gotten older, I've probably appreciated that idea of what American music is, you know. It's yeah. and I've become very insulated with that, mm. you know, I tend not to, and I, not that I have anything against it, I tend not to listen to, like, pop music from around the world. Yeah. I like more regional stuff. Mm-hmm. If I listen to a band from Spain, I like to hear a band from Spain. You
yeah.
know what I mean? I don't want to mm-hmm. hear a pop band that's an international star, you know. I mean, I yeah. want to hear that local
yeah.
sound. And I feel that way here, whether it's Pittsburgh or Pennsylvania or whatever, and America itself has that.
Yeah, right. And again, I think, you know, because I'm someone too, I mean, I turned off pop radio around 2000, 2001, mm-hmm. you know. It's funny, I ejected the CD, and I won't say what local radio station was playing or that the girlfriend set the car radio to, but it was the station I listened to when I turned the radio off for good. And they were playing a song that I recognized from back then. And I was like, yeah. really? really? Because I've heard lots of really interesting and fun things in the last 15 years. You know, and you think, even, you know, think locally. I mean, there's that Pit Punk blog or website. He's doing a thing, you know, 365 Pittsburgh bands in 365 days.
Wow.
Just what
it's amazing,
yeah. What we got going here,
yeah.
There's so much fun, and it's almost like, yeah, why listen to something that's so abstract and distant and
right?
You know, you those people don't even seem human, you know,
right?
Whereas, you know, I could, you know, pay $3 and go to Excuses and see yeah. you and have this grand time, and sort of you think even like a room like that is so fits because it kind of has. You know, the Forbes Field sign, this yeah. feeling of sort of old Pittsburgh or historic Pittsburgh, which I think, right. that's the other thing I think for us as Americans. I mean, we are still such a new country, and
exactly,
a 100-year-old house is an old house. Right. Where I have colleagues who teach at the branch campus in Rome or whatever, study abroad thing, and my apartment's in a building that was built in the 14th century. Right. You think about all of the human life that happened, and on those streets and in those walls and stuff.
Right, right.
Whereas,
and it makes you, you think about that, and it puts everything in perspective. What this music that we have, it's fairly new.
Yeah.
And we're just trying to figure it all out,
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. I think that's the other thing, too. Our sense of time right now is so immediate, right. But, are we still at the experimental stage of rock and roll, maybe even?
I think you're right. We talked about this earlier, too, was the fact that, with technology the way it is, we have so many opportunities to hear so many different things. Sometimes we may be oversaturated with it.
Yeah.
I don't know, maybe the artists that actually have something to say, that maybe they'll, they kind of pop out at you every so often.
Yeah.
But not in a way that it did before, like the Beatles. I don't see that happening,
Yeah, yeah. And you think about it, for me, I think I just hear pop music as being so stagnant.
Right.
But yet you have, and I guess, if you're like me and you sort of just turned off pop radio, I think the other thing is, I think now the experience of music is so personal,
Exactly.
And what I do is unlike what other people do. And,
right.
I still buy records. I still do. I still buy physical medium. Yeah. If somebody gives me an iTunes gift card, I use it. But that's not, and so it's for me, it's I buy a record and I listen to that record.
Yeah.
And that's the thing that I'm into.
Well, that's one of the things that I wanted to do with this record here, with Deep in the Shadows, was that, we got it to a point where we had 9 songs. We recorded actually, I think, 10 or 11. One or two didn't make it on the CD. But I wanted to get it to be like 44 minutes. 22 minutes aside. the ideal album,
Yeah.
So...
yeah, that's right. 22 minutes aside. I know there's that Bob Mould record where he actually put the sound of the arm swinging back.
Oh.
actually, after track 5 and track 10.
Yeah.
He actually put that on there.
Yeah.
And it's like really quiet. And he had to like, I was like, why is there this weird gap? And the song, and I cranked it. And I heard that. I was like, and I remembered what that song was, Which I guess that's the other thing, too, is that you think about authentic, because... I actually brought a record player to class last week because I had something. We were reading a play, and I found the original Broadway cast recording of that play. And so, all my students were like, whoa, we've heard about these things, and we kind of want one, or some of our friends have one.
Yeah.
And I think it is that, it almost is this reaction of music as being this sort of, intangible thing that you download illegally or illegally, and as soon as you're bored with it, it disappears,
Right.
Well, a record or even a CD is, you have to maintain it. You have to, you have to do something with it to make it.
You have to physically connect to it somehow,
Yeah.
You have to get up and change it, You have to flip it over.
Yeah. Clean it off and flip it over, right? I think in a way it goes, for me sometimes it's too far, because then you have the band that puts out the double album. It doesn't have to be a double album, it's a couple of them I've seen that are like 45 RPM, so you can get 2 discs out of it. And it's just like,
do that with CDs too. They'll put, like, because you could shove 75 minutes on a CD, I think it is now.
Yeah, so, close to 80 actually.
Yeah, right? And so people just like, I don't want to listen to somebody's album that long. I don't know what it, unless it's very, very interesting.
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
Yeah. Well, and I think, too, I want to go back to what you're saying about this sort of glut of great. Because there's even just so many things going on in this town. And you think about, well, what's the Cleveland scene? What's Cleveland? What's Buffalo? Pittsburgh has what we have. I think, thinking about that... that sort of blog project that guy's doing, and just shows that I can, you know, see for like $5 at a place like Gooskies. Yeah. You know, if there was a sort of all-time, you know, league of bands or whatever, you know, in a championship or a Final Four, I mean, I think Pittsburgh's got a better chance at winning that than the Penguins do with the getting the Stanley Cup this year, you know? Yeah. You know what I mean? But there's just so much good stuff, and you think, I mean, I've had those nights where I've been at shows, you know, including some of yours, where I think this is one of the best things in the world happening right now. Mm. And there's, you know, 50 people here, 20 people here, 10 people here.
Yeah.
You know, I have some friends who played me some demos that are on their, you know, recording, the computer they record on. And he's like, yeah, you know, my friend was like, yeah, you're the only person outside the band that's heard these. And it's some of the best songs I've heard in a long time. And I'm thinking, wow. It's just on a hard drive.
Yeah.
You know, and so with that glut, you think there's so many people doing such good work.
Right.
You know, it's a hard thing to adjust to, because I think about, you know, I read in like Adbusters, you know, that radical leftist magazine, you know, the future is going to be small, slow, and local. You know, the sort of maybe the big corporate world and monoculture is going to just kind of collapse under its own weight, or things are going to happen historically, or people are just going to decide. And a lot of people do, I think, you know, consciously to just reject it. So you have this, you know, small, slow, local future, which is certainly not the future that we thought it was going to be. Well, and I think about, maybe does music kind of fit into that? Is music maybe ahead of the curve there, when you can have a house concert even?
Right.
You know, I have friends who sometimes they pass through from New York and play by house. Yeah. And for them, they says that's more lucrative sometimes than above ground touring, you know? And is music just maybe ahead of that curve?
Yeah. I mean, I'm not sure that the general audience is that in tuned to think that way.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, well, you know, I have my, you know, my thing about how I you know, when iTunes happened, and, you know, we had National Record Mart in this region.
Right.
All of those sort of big corporate chain record stores. I was at the Indiana Mall a few months back, and the FYE there was still open.
Hmm.
And I was just like, a record store in a mall.
Yeah, that's crazy, huh?
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, it was this thing that was sort of ubiquitous. I remember that was the only place I was able to buy music was at the mall, you know. Not the, you know, because my parents wouldn't let me go to the scary place downtown, you know. So I had to go to the mall to find my punk CDs. And now I was like, wow, this still exists. I mean, this is now the relic in its own time almost. And my whole thing is, I think, you know, sort of like with, you know, bookstores kind of collapsing and borders going away, you know, we still have bookstores. In fact, Pittsburgh probably has, I think, more bookstores now than it's had a couple of years ago. Because it's just like, it is the geeks, it's the hobbyists, it's the people who take it way too seriously. You know, like, there's always going to be that for them.
Right.
And I guess, I don't know, Kate Black and Toby Keith for everybody else? Or, I mean,
I guess, you know,
and the rest of us real people will just sort of like have our music and our tunes. And
I don't know how, you know, how people see music sometimes. I mean, I just, I got to a point where I just do what I feel is, for me, just honest work. What happens after that, I have no control.
Yeah, that's true.
And it plays better on my mind if I don't think about it too.
Yeah, well, that's true. I mean, but again, I think it's, you know, that intrinsic, to loop back to, you know, the thing we were talking about at the beginning, that sort of intrinsic just love and belief in what you're doing.
Yeah,
and that, exactly. And at the end of the day, you know, I had a friend who I met in grad school who, his band made a record, and I thought it was a great record. And, you know, they did, it was the height of the sort of grunge alternative, you know, his claim to fame was they opened for Soundgarden once. You know, and has these like crazy stories of what it was like to be a touring band, and how the one time they filled the van up with gas, enough gas to get from Chicago to home, then was Albuquerque. They had a dollar left and they were hungry. And so they went to the dollar store and they bought a big box of flake mashed potatoes. And they would grab handfuls of the flakes and just shove the dry flakes in their mouth. and just chew on it a little bit and work it around and like make like mashed potatoes with the saliva.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, and having to do stuff that it's like, well, we just drew, if we drove all night, we knew that there would be. I knew I had cold cuts in the fridge.
Yeah.
As soon as we got in, and doing stuff like that, and you know, he had this CD that he made and got pressed, and I think he still, at the time I met him, he's like, "You want one?" I was like, "Sure," and I loved it. And he still had a couple thousand copies of it left. And he felt like a, you know, like a failure or whatever. I said, I didn't sell out I all these CDs and all this stuff. And it was this thing. And we played. And I just, as someone who wishes he could play music, you know, I have a left-handed bass down there, but I'm not good. I was like, yeah, but dude, you did it. You made it. You put something into the world. And there's no one can take that away from you.
Right.
Even if, you know, really crappy pop band got, right. You know,
well, that's the grand that's the whole idea of it, you know. And I was talking to the producer of our records, last couple records, Will Kimbrough, who's a great artist himself, and we spoke about this over a couple of drinks one night, and he said the same thing, is that, you know, no matter what happens, you know, whether you sell 10 copies or 10,000 copies, it's still there. You still have to do it. You know, it's, you know, what do they call that? The war of art.
Yeah.
You know, if nobody listens, are you still going to write?
And yeah.
The answer is yes. I mean, for the true artist, I mean, yes, you're still going to create something.
Yeah.
And if you can live with that, it's very rewarding.
Yeah.
You know?
Absolutely. And I'm thinking too about it. You think all of those people who, you know, it's usually only painters and poets are before their time. But, right. You know, I just watched on YouTube last weekend this great documentary about Nick Drake, who, you know, and I mean, his is a tragedy. I mean, he died heartbroken, you know, but he made 4 really great records that now every year, you know, sell more copies than he sold of in his entire lifetime. Each one of his albums sells, and they're just so influential and so big. Sure. And, you know, there's that Searching for Sugar Man documentary. Yeah. All of that, these things that are sort of like these gems that are still out there waiting to be found. And I think about that sometimes, even, you know, in this town, all the other towns, you know, there's so much great. You know, I always say, you know, if I live to be 100, if I stop buying books, watching movie, you know, or whatever, seeing new films, if I just picked a date and stopped, I could live to 100 and not experience all the great things there are in the world. That's sort of overwhelming, you know? It is,
yeah.
But, I mean, is it, though, for you, do you feel like there is, like, once it's on the record, once it's out, is there, like, a sense of permanence to it?
No, not at all. Actually, for me, the music is always changing. And a great example is the fact that, you know, a lot of times I'll be performing, and we may play a song that I recorded, you know, 15 years ago. And all of a sudden it becomes something new to me for some reason. You know, it means something a little different. And, you know, we can present it differently now. I don't think music is ever, you know, ever stops evolving. For me, it doesn't. You know, I never want to put a stamp on it and say, this is it.
This is it, yeah. Wow, so it is, yeah. The great American poet, Donald Hall, because I remember I would freak out when I would try to write poetry. Is it done? Is it done? Is it done?
Right.
And I was at a conference, and he said, you know, he has stuff that's sort of in the English textbooks, you know, that's anthologized to that level of, it's like people study it in high school even and stuff. His readers' copies of the books when he goes out to read, he's still messing with commas.
Yeah.
You know, he's still doing something. He's still revising.
Right.
You know, but he gets to a point where he said, well, it's good enough for public consumption, but it's still working in my mind.
Yeah, sure.
You know.
Yep. Oh, yeah. Definitely.
Yeah. And so I want to talk about maybe some of the individual songs in this record, or at least the ones that, you know, this is the, well, the ones I really like. So, and sort of talk about sort of what, where they come from, and sort of maybe, how about this? Can we say what they mean for you now? You know, and you know, as you're performing, you know, in 20 years from now, you know, but I got no use for what you're selling me is such a great way to start that record.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and so rich and.
Yeah, that song, you know, lyrically, it's you know, it actually was written around the time of political debate, and it was written around the time of probably the last, I don't know if it's the last presidential race, and, you know, these politicians, and maybe it was even local politicians, and they're on the TV every hour, you know, and they're just telling you what you want to hear.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. I always say that no politician is ever going to say we're going to raise taxes. You know what I mean. Mm-hmm. Nobody wants to say that, but it's part of life.
Yeah.
You know, there's only, you only can fund the schools and education, you know, in ways of collecting money. So when somebody says they're not going to raise taxes, you know, and I don't know if it was coming from the far right was trying to sell me something that I didn't want to hear. And also, you know, I remember thinking about race and how that, you know, everything is so much better now. And this is even before the Ferguson problems, you know. And I kept thinking, you know, I still see it. I still see these problems out there. So they're trying to sell me something that doesn't exist. You know, there's still a problem there.
Yeah, and I think, too, you know, we have such a hard time, I don't know, dealing with the funk or, you know what I mean, or whatever. Mm-hmm. You're right, you know. I remember in 2004... one of the Kerry Bush debates, they got a bunch of undecided voters together.
Yeah.
And there was what was the lowest point of the night where they just kind of had to, like, turn this knob if they liked what they were hearing or what they didn't. And they started talking about the casualties in the war.
Right.
And that was they didn't want to hear that. And it was like, no, we're in a war. Maybe we should talk about sacrifice middle of a war.
It's exactly what I'm talking about. And I used this soul music from the 60s because of that, you know, it goes back to when I was a kid and watching television during the Vietnam War.
Mm-hmm.
And they would show the coffins coming off the planes. Yeah. Now, you notice in Afghanistan and Iraq, they never do. They don't show these things.
Yeah.
So it's all to me, it's so deliberate to try to sell people what they only the things that they want.
Yeah.
You know, and sometimes you need to face facts.
Yeah, you know, and face truth reality. Is painful. And
truth is painful. And sometimes you're a better person if you can get by that. So that's sort of what that's about.
Yeah, so speaking of, like, painful truths, now thinking about, I'm going to skip ahead. I'm not going to do this sequentially then. Be careful what you wish for, which is another record, a song for me that's like, whoa, you know.
Right,
they're all good, but then I that's the way I synced in the album. Like, sort of clash onto things, and then I keep listening, and then I get bored. Yeah. But then there's something. Oh yeah, I didn't listen. I didn't notice that the first time. But yeah, so be careful what you wish for. Which has that? What's that great line? It's just a blanket of loneliness and a bed of doubt.
Yeah,
yeah. Me and my friend got to the parking garage. They went to that and parked, and I was like, all right.
I was listening to a friend of mine. Actually, it wasn't a friend of mine. It was somebody that I didn't even know, but he was playing a set, singer songwriter, and his name is Joe Massiano, and I never met him before, but I thought his songs were so interesting. The lyrics were just, he had something. So I talked to him after the show, and I says, you know, man, we should get together and write a song. We should get together and write a little bit. So he sent me these basic lyrics of a song, and it was a country. You know, singer-songwriter type of country song. Mm. And I can't even remember if the title was Be Careful What You Wish For, or, you know, something to that effect. So I changed a little bit around. You know, I changed some things around, kept some of what he had, and I thought, man, this is a soul song. You know, this is a soul song, and so that's how that came about. But it was started by Joe Massiano, who's a songwriter, and Steve Binsberger helped write that one as well. The music.
That's the cautionary example, which then you lead. The next is, you know, I Ain't Worried, which is like a gospel song, right? I mean, it is, you know, because there's a big gospel influence I hear on this record, too, you know.
There's always that underlying spirituality. Mm. I'm not a religious person whatsoever, but I'm very interested in the spiritual side of life. And I think that everybody has their own, and I find it interesting that people are always interested in saving other people's souls. I find that interesting.
Yeah.
I find it a little strange, to be honest with you. Like, why do they care about other? Like, I don't know. I just think that if I believed that, you know, I was going to spend the rest of my life in heaven, I don't want all these other people there with me. So, you know, let's just leave them out of it.
Yes.
But anyways,
yeah.
So that's religion to me is just kind of odd, but spirituality. So I always got that kind of running theme, and I love gospel music.
Which in and of itself is this blend of sort of sadness and joy,
yeah,
you know?
I love that. You know, that dramatic, comedy versus tragedy. You know, I love that. I love the playing around with that. And but this song, I actually wrote this song when I was in Italy, just sitting at the kitchen table at the apartment that I was at in Bologna. And just the word just came to, I mean, I didn't even have any music to it. The word just came to me. And so the band, you know, when I started putting the music to it, it was very, very New Orleans sounding, you know, really a funky New Orleans sound to it. So.
And so actually, you know, so when you do, you know, get together with the band and sort of put some meat on these bones or whatever.
Right.
You know, I think it also should be mentioned that you have this like great cadre of accomplished musicians
they're amazing.
I mean, what effect do they have on your imagination when you think about then what's possible?
Oh, everything's possible. That's the idea. You know, that's what makes it so easy. When I came out of playing with Joe Grushecki and the House Rockers, and I started really seriously writing, even before that, I guess I should say. I wanted to be able to be self-reliant. I wanted to be able to write songs that I could present in multiple ways, because I knew that by having a band all the time is almost impossible sometimes. I mean, you don't have the money to have a band on hold anytime you play a gig. But I'm very lucky to be able to have friends and to know enough people in the music business around here that are just so accomplished. And all the guys that I have now are so very accomplished in the rhythm and blues, rock and roll side of thing. And that's just exactly where I'm heading and where I've been coming from, you know. So it works out well. And, it does keep the, you know, when I write a song, I don't really worry too much about,
are they going to be able to play this?
Yeah,
are they going to be able to do it? You can just kind of, the no-look pass behind the back, and you know the other player is going to be there kind of thing. But I'm sure that does give you some incredible freedom or thinking about, well, what if it sounds like this, and I can do this, and I can do that, and, you know.
Well, a lot of this record, too, I mean, even with Memphis as well, we try to play together as much as possible in the studio. Because, you never know what's going to happen. I mean, we really, you know, I try to arrange it and get everything where we should have it. But, boy, sometimes things start taking off and you just sort of play to your strengths.
Yeah.
You know, Steve might be doing something on the piano and I'll just let that go for a while. Then we might change to somewhere else. And that feeling, you're just trying to capture that moment. And that's the magic of it.
Yeah, I was thinking about, you're right, I mean, was it Frank Black for a while there would just record his albums during sound checks for shows? A couple of those Catholics records.
Yeah.
They're so live. Sound checks. He had a mobile recording studio, would just do everything live to a 2-track, and yeah, he would just sound check it, and eventually that would just become a record, which is also good because then they didn't have to learn to play the songs live.
Right.
That was nice and efficient, but
yeah, because who likes to rehearse? Jeez.
Who likes to rehearse? Or I remember once reading a thing about Billy Corgan of the Smashing Pumpkins and how he would, for the vocal tracks for some of those records, he would sing a song 33 times.
Wow.
Was the magic number. And then he would chop up and pick, like, what's the best and of the 33?
Yeah, that would drive me.
And it would go word by word. And I just thought, wow,
I don't have that in me.
He's, you know, if you read anything about his celebrity or his personality, he's so weirdly obsessive. And
yeah, that to me, that's when you lose the soul part of it. I don't know.
Speaking of soul, we are running short of time, but I want to talk about Darkest Side of Town, which is even a song that, like, live, you know, it's like one of those, like, I remember hearing that song at Excuses and going, I want to own that on a record someday.
Yeah.
You know, and you've made my dreams come true. I can order it up whenever I want, you know.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not disgustingly rich, and we can't bring back the patronage system. You know, if I would, there'd be a lot of people in this town be getting paid.
You know?
But you'd be on, you'd have to have a beeper or something. You know? 3 in the morning. I need Bill Tom's, you know. But the CD's nice. So
yeah,
talking about
that song. It was one of the first ones that I wrote as part of this. Actually, I think it was "I Ain't Worried" was one of the first ones. But this was early on, and really, it's just about finding a little slice of heaven on the other side of the tracks.
Yeah,
I remember as a young kid sneaking into the Decade in Oakland, underage, you know.
Yeah.
The Decade, if anybody out there remembers the Decade, they remembered it was the front door and then the side door. And if you couldn't get in, they didn't let you in the front door, you can possibly go to the side door. That's how we used to sneak in. But I remember going there and seeing bands and whatever, and I just remember thinking, this is the greatest, this is where I feel the most at home, you know. In those days, you smoke, so you use like a smoky bar, you know, smoky bar with rock and roll music playing and blues and all that, you know. And I thought that was the coolest thing. So this song, "Darkest Side of Town," is sort of about that. It's about, you know, escaping. You know, I imagine that young kid. You know, walking outside, walking down the street and hearing, you know, I don't know, Skip James playing in a jute joint, you know.
That's
what goes through my head, you know.
Maybe it's why, because I could relate to that. Because, you know, again, I grew up in some place that was very nice and very suburban. It was nice and suburban and everything was nice. And, of course, I, you know, got into the funk and the filth and the punk and the, you know, whatever. Right. All of those things that are sort of like, you know, a little ragged around the edges, and just going, yeah, you know, this is so much more interesting and exciting. And and to think you've, you know, that guy, that kid who would break into the, or sneak into the Decade now, I mean, you've made your own franchise, right?
Yeah.
You carry that with you
to
Excuses or Moondogs or Club Cafe, and you can make that, which is kind of amazing. You know?
And I've had people, you know, come to me and say, oh, you know, your music got me through, you know, whatever, college, you know, this class or whatever, you know. And I think about that, like, because I can remember that happening to me, you know, when I was young. And, you know, and still now, and I'm in my mid-50s, you know, I still think that way. It's weird. You know, I don't have, until I walk by a mirror and I look at myself and I go, oh, shit, you're an old fart, you know, but I still have that same, I'm 20 years old, feeling inside when it comes to this this music that I love so much, you know.
Yeah.
So I'm a little more sore. And that's the last verse of the song is, you know, there's snow on the mountain.
Yeah.
You know, or and the rooster still, but the rooster still crows. You know? Yeah.
Well, in that happy note, I think it's time for the bottom five. Bottom five is a series of questions not related to our main topic, though actually a couple of them kind of are, that are of a surrealistic and or philosophical nature. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
I'm ready. I actually had to pull out the form. I found the form from the last one. So I was like, I can't ask you the same questions twice. Okay. This is a new bottom five. All right. Number one, what is the strangest injury you've ever suffered?
The strangest injury. Wow. I don't know if I had a strange injury.
No weird accidents. No, like, how did I hurt? How was that possible? I had one of the early guests. She was riding a bike, and the handlebars just came up, detached themselves from the bike, and she was just, you know, merrily pedaling along her way as a kid. And then next thing you know, she's holding the handlebars in front of her face, going.
I can remember, I don't know, dramatic.
Nothing that dramatic. Yeah,
but. I was playing with the House Rockers at the time, and it was a Friday, and I was working in a metal shop at the time, and I cut myself on a big hunk of metal underneath a radio arm saw, you know, and I cut my left hand, the top of my finger on my left hand, my third finger, and I had two shows that weekend, you know, Friday and Saturday night. And so as I was playing, you know, I tried to wrap it and do all the things. And as I'm playing, it just kept opening up. So I had this blood just rushing down my hand and my arm.
Oh.
And people were just really getting into it, you know. Thinking that I'm ripping myself apart playing the guitar, you know. And it really wasn't that. It was like I hurt at work. You know?
Yeah. Well, this is not Tony Iommi, but wow. Yeah, right. Yeah, that's... Yeah. Oh, wow. That's... we want blood. We went to a bad place. All right. Is there a thing... Question two. Is there a thing that most people seem to be afraid of, but you're not?
Boy, that's a good question. No, I'm pretty much as scared of everything that everybody else is scared of.
Snakes, spiders, heights.
No, I'm not scared of any of that stuff.
Oh, well, there you go. There you go. Snakes, spiders.
No, I'm not scared of that.
Bring your anaconda to the next Hard Rain show.
Yeah, throw snakes at me. It doesn't really matter.
Say that one. Save us. Okay, question three. Maybe this will be happier. Actually, okay, this would be good. What is one pop culture text or personal, like, cultural thing you wish more people did or knew about? Is there something out there, a band, an album, a book, that you just wish that for you is like, this is the greatest thing ever, but it seems to be like nobody else knows about it, and you wish that, like, everybody had heard or had read or had seen thing X?
Wow, that's a good question, too. There's so many books that I read that I think, you know, you got to read this that nobody takes me up on sometimes. But
like what recently?
Well, I just read this. I'm a history buff, and so I read The Fiery Trials of Abraham Lincoln, which was about his struggle and his political moves for emancipation and the aftermath of that, and I really relate it when I read these things. I can really, really put it in current times, you know what I mean? Like, I can really see how things don't change. And I think that's one of the things. I don't know if that's what you're talking about, but I think that I'd like people to see that times don't necessarily change as much as they think they do.
Yeah.
And going back to the record, times ain't nothing like they used to be, which is really about that same theme that I got from, you know, so.
Nice tie-in. Yeah. All right. Actually, keep this going. Actually, this is weird. It's like a mind meld thing. Question four, and I picked these out beforehand. What's the biggest injustice in the world right now? Speaking of maybe times not so much changing.
in the world? Wow.
Yes.
Jeez. I really believe that times don't change as much as people think they do. I don't think there's any more injustice now than there was 400 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, I really don't. I think people are basically the same with different ideas. I mean, different visions and different goals, but I think the biggest problems that I would see is to take hope or hope and dream away from a young person. I think that's the biggest injustice that you can do for anybody. And there's so many people. I mean, like, and again, we go back to this, you know, this history thing that I really enjoy in reading about. The trials of Abraham Lincoln and the emancipation, and you go back and you think about how not only the African Americans but the Native Americans were treated, and basically the hopes and goals and dreams were taken away from people. And I think that's what binds everybody together, as we all think alike. People don't want to believe that, but we all have goals and dreams and hopes,
needs.
Yeah, and they may be different, but they're all this.
The packaging is different, yeah, you know. It's old wine, new bottles, or
right.
You know, yeah. All right, you're almost out of the woods.
Okay.
Question 5, which is a new one. You're the first guest to ever get this question.
Uh-oh. Better hold on to my seat.
Yeah. Yes. you're the experimental one. You're the dog the Russians shot into space.
Yeah.
Poor Laika. Is there an artist in another, I would say, discipline or medium that you wish you could be like? So is there, or at least make stuff like, so is there, like, is there somebody, man, I wish I could make a movie like he or she does. I wish I could write like a book like, you know, I wish I could paint like, kind of thing. Is there an artist in who does a different form of art that you wish, like, man, it wasn't for this music thing.
Yeah. Wow. That's good. I mean, there's a lot of, like, there's a few, secret, oh, I don't know. I mean, I think, you know, like I think back about, you know, poets, you know, and I got a poetry book coming out probably this year.
Oh.
So it's something that I've always, you know, kind of went back and forth with my whole life, you know. So, you know, I don't know. I read poetry on occasion now, you know, and so, like, Robert Frost, would it be kind of cool to be Robert Frost? You know, how do you live like that, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I have Robert Frost on vinyl.
He was reading
not long before he passed away.
Wow,
yeah.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, and, you know, the thing about Robert Frost, too, is he's someone who is almost sort of ruined by his success. He even said before the end of his life is he wished he could take back Stopping by the Woods, Snowy, and The Road Not Taken.
Mm-hmm.
And he said because, you know, he knew that that would overshadow all the other great things that he wrote. And unfortunately, that's happened to him. You know, the people fixate on those two poems and they become almost sort of like...
It's sort of like Warren Zevon who wrote Werewolves of London.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's how people know him. But he got all these great songs.
Yes.
These dark, cold, underground songs. But that's what people knew him by, you know, one song.
Yeah, the horror of success.
Yeah.
And I think that's about it for everything Bill Toms related in the universe. Go to BillToms.com. His CD release show for Deep in the Shadows is Saturday, March 28th at Club Cafe, and that's March 28th, 2015, as this lives on in perpetuity in cyberspace. You can also pick up his other 8 solo records that are also great. Memphis, Live at Moondogs, which is the one I need. You can get that at BillToms.com. The links will be on our website, too. Our next episode will eventually happen, and it will be about something.
Our homepage, where you can find new and old episodes, is GonnaDiePodcast.com. We're also on iTunes. Follow us on Twitter at GonnaDiePodcast. And We're All Gonna Die is on Facebook and Google Plus, if Google Plus even indeed exists. Thanks to Brett Zork, as always, for the lovely theme music, Later Meets.